BBC Five Live.
On to the tech phone-in then with Fevzi Turkalp from GadgetDetective.com. You can text us right now, 85058, with all your tech questions. He'll provide the tech answers. You can call us on 08085 909 693. Email upallnight at bbc.co.uk, and we are on social media as well. The address there at BBC Five Live. Hi there, Fevzi.
Morning.
Hi. You've got a very funny story tonight in your list of topics that we're going to be discussing, and I'd like to talk about that one first, simply because we're hoping that people will also get in contact with us this evening about their tech troubles and the problems that they've had when tech has gone wrong for them, despite everything that they've done being completely correct. You know, they've followed the manual, the instructions, everything's been fine, but the computer still said no. This all surrounds, I understand, an Amazon Echo smart speaker. What's the situation?
Yeah, so journalist actually living in Mumbai in India took to social media to declare his surprise after his voice-activated device began limiting him to listen to only one BBC local radio station. So one of the things you can do with an Amazon Echo is that you say the name of the trigger word, and then you tell it you want to listen to a certain station, and it uses an app called TuneIn to select that station, and it keeps giving him BBC Radio Guernsey.
Okay.
And there's nothing wrong with BBC Radio Guernsey, fine radio station, in fact. However, irrespective of which station he asked for, it would play him that. So there's a nice video on the BBC website about this happening. I think I can tell him where the problem is, actually. I don't think Amazon Echoes are set up to work in India.
Oh, okay.
By the sounds of him, he's a British journalist, so I suspect what he's done is he's taken his Echo out there. And these devices are very localized to particular countries, so much so that the first Echoes came out in America about 2 years before they were available here. So if they work at all, they would only work after a fashion. I mean, I've tried it on an Echo here, and we're not having that problem. We can pretty much pick whichever radio station we choose, including this one. And if I pick this one now, it's really going to confuse all of us, so I'm not going to do that. But
okay.
But yeah, that's the crux of the story. Man has Echo. Echo insists on BBC Radio Guernsey.
I see. And is there a particular reason why it wouldn't particularly work in India?
In some ways, you'd think it should, but a lot of the services are localized. Obviously, you've got the speech first of all as well. I mean, it's not localized to India because it speaks English with an English accent. So the British Echo speaks English with an English accent, American Echo with an American one. But a lot of the services aren't set up correctly. So things like traffic, weather and so forth has to be able to access relevant services. A lot of things just won't work. It sounds like it works after a fashion, but it's not fully working, and it's certainly not going to be supported by Amazon.
And we're hoping that people will text us and email us and indeed call us with their stories of tech gone wrong tonight, tech mishaps. When has the computer said no to you? You can text us on 85058 with those little, hopefully, funny stories. You can email us on upallnight@bbc.co.uk. And you can call us on 08085 909 693. And of course, any tech questions you have, Fevzi will hopefully be able to provide the answer over the next 90 minutes or so here on Up All Night. Let's start, Fevzi, tonight with Frank, who's a truck driver, says it's time for a dreaded phone upgrade. He asks, which do you think is best, the Samsung or the iPhone, for a truck driver?
Ooh, okay, so top-end Samsungs, Galaxy and Galaxy Notes are excellent devices, arguably have slightly more advanced hardware than the best of the iPhones, even though Apple have just released their sort of catch-up iPhone 8 and 8 Plus, and the 10 is imminent now. It really depends on what you want. For example, if you've already owned a smartphone and you have apps for it, then there's a benefit in continuing with what you have, in that the apps that you have will continue to work, be they Apple apps or Android apps. If you want, I guess, the easiest user experience and the smoothest one and the sort of the best choice of apps, I would say, Apple probably pips its competitors. If, however, you want to have, For example, a phone that gives you the ability, you could choose a phone that gives you upgradable storage, so a memory card slot. None of the Apple iPhones have got a memory card slot, so the memory you buy it with is the memory you get. If you want a larger screen than is available at the moment from Apple, or if you just want more control over the setup of your phone, its look, its feel, and so forth, then the Android phone is better. I think for a lot of users, if you can afford it, the Apple experience is probably still a better one, but I think the difference between them is less than it used to be.
And certainly the cost difference is now, is that still quite high? I mean, if you're talking, because the iPhone X famously is, £1,000 or about to be, and various mobile phone companies getting into quite a lot of hot water over the last few weeks with some fairly high prices for monthly deals. Is it the same with Samsung as well?
I think, yes, at the top end, there's not really much in it. I mean, there's not too much what they used to term as Apple tax on these devices. There is a bit. But not much. I'd say the cost is more to do with the fact that, you know, when you have to buy up front the unit with as much memory as you think you'll ever need, because you cannot upgrade it. Whereas that's also true of some of the Samsungs, by the way, as well. But some Samsung phones have, and indeed other Android phones have, the ability to upgrade. And that's kind of important, because it allows you to use the phone for longer. You're not forced, and more economically, because you're not forced to buy all the memory you think you would ever need. And memory card slots are also good, because as you own the phone, the cost of memory tends to get cheaper. So if you can go a year without having to, you know, pop a memory card in there, and then you do, then you'll probably get about twice the memory as you would have done if you bought it now. So there are a lot of benefits. Also think about the apps that you want to run. I mean, I for example, have a particular passion for running apps that are recreations of classic electronic synthesizers from the sort of 80s and so forth.
That is very niche.
but it almost doesn't exist in any way, shape or form on Android. There are a couple of exceptions to that, but on Apple there is a rich range of these synthesizers. So a synth that, you know, I think I'll give you an example. There's something called a Moog, or some people say Moog, Model 15. It's a modular synthesizer. It's one of these ones where you can actually buy it in hardware. It's box after box of synthesizer linked together with patch wires, and incredibly powerful synthesizer. If you buy the hardware version of that, it's $10,000.
Yes.
I can run it on my iPhone and iPad, and it's I forget the price, but it's about £20 or £30, and it's functionally identical. Of course, you don't get to twiddle the physical knobs in quite the same way, but an amazing thing. And since that, you know, maybe one would still pick up on, you know, eBay and literally spend thousands on, again, can be had for pennies in some cases. So for something like that, but it's worth having a look at any apps that you might want to run and make sure that they are available on both, because not everything is available on Android, and not everything to the same quality. Apple's strength is also its weakness. So its strength is that there are only a few handsets that people have to write for, and software writers like it because it's a more predictable. Whereas with Android, you know, there are many different brands and many different changing models, and it's difficult. But the weakness of Apple is if you're not happy with what they're offering you, there's no other choice. I mean, you can't get iOS from any other manufacturer. Whereas with Android, you could go Samsung, or, you know, you could go HTC, or you could go LG or Sony or what have you. And so you can get much more of the sort of the look, the feel, the screen size and the facilities that you want. So it really depends what you're after, I'd say.
Absolutely. 08085 909 693 is the number to call with all your tech questions for Fevzi tonight here on Up All Night. We are at BBC Five Live on social media. You can email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. And as ever, you can text us on 85058. Let's have a quick check of the emails. Anthony has email from Milton Keynes. He'd like to know which sound system or home theatre is best appreciated for home use. Is it right to combine different makes of speaker, amplifier and engine, he says, to form a unit? Or should you just get a sort of all-in-one system? What do you think?
So with audio, all-in-one systems are more convenient, and indeed even separate systems, but from the same manufacturer, have a convenience in that they can be operated from a single remote control more easily. They're designed to work together. But having said that, you know, a manufacturer of speakers, for example, isn't the manufacturer of the best speakers you can buy and the most suitable speakers for your budget is not necessarily the same as the manufacturer of your audio source or your amplifier. So in fact, this goes back to the day of sort of hi-fi separates and so forth, and this was, you know, people would spend a lot of time working out what would go with what and going and listening to them, would you believe, and not just going from specs tell you almost nothing when it comes to audio. Your ears will tell you a good deal more. So I would say, if you've got the time and the inclination and you're interested, i.e. you're an audiophile, then separates with components which don't have to, they could be of the same brand, but they don't have to be of the same brand, that's the way to go. If, however, you want convenience, then obviously an all-in-one system is better. One of the things about having separates, by the way, is that you can swap out components as time changes. So I've got a hi-fi stack. I've still got these separate units. Originally it was fed by a cassette deck and a turntable. Turntable's still going. Cassette mm-hmm. deck's still going, actually. Then a mini disc recorder and player.
That lasted about 2 years.
Yeah, but I still like it. Still found in a lot of smaller local radio stations, mini disc, by the way. It's still much loved medium because has a lot of the flexibility of CD, but also the editability of tape. So people still like that. But we went through CDs and now you've got all these streaming services, but those can all still use the same amp and speakers. And of course, turntables made a comeback, so people dusted those down and their vinyl collections and brought them out. So there's a lot of joy. But things changed. When Apple launched the first iPod, there was a sort of subtle shift, and many people didn't really notice it at the time, and we moved away from audiophiles, that's to say people interested in the best quality they could get, the best reproduction they could get from their systems. We moved from quality to quantity. Steve Jobs held aloft the iPod and declared how many, of your records you could fit on it. And it became an arms race in terms of capacity rather than quality. So, we got more and more, and you could carry a whole record collection. Now we got streaming services. You can carry quite literally millions of records with you in essence, because you can access everything all the time. And even the concept of the record collection or music collection is going away. This idea that we have this sort of self-curated music collection where we just start buying music at a certain age and continue, throughout our lives, and that this collection becomes the story of our lives, the diary of our lives. That's sort of given way to just this huge, omnipresent library of music that you can access at all times. And there are benefits to both, because if you have good discoverability tools, you can access all sorts of music that you would never have, gone into a shop and bought, or even chosen to buy and download. So there's benefits to both, but I think it's amazing to me that a lot of these streaming services now still, don't have the same quality as CD, and CD came out, I think, in the early 80s. And still, we're dealing with these highly compressed files. There's some shift away from that, but still it's about quantity, not quality.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we've got a computer question from Brenda in York, who's called us. Hi there, Brenda.
Hi.
Hi, Brenda.
Hi.
You got a problem with Windows Vista, I think.
Well, not a problem with. My office machine, I run Windows Vista, which is now not supported by anything. My question is, I am a technophobe. Despite having a laptop as well and a mobile phone and a tablet, I only want to switch them on and use them. Mm-hmm. I don't understand how they work. I don't want to. How can I upgrade to something more useful? than Windows Vista on my office machine.
Okay, so it's possible in most cases to upgrade. Did the machine come with Windows Vista, by the way, Brenda?
Yes, it was set up with that.
Right, okay. So a machine that came with Windows Vista on it initially when it was new will almost certainly be able to run Windows 7, which is not the current operating system because after 7 there was 8, 8.1 and 10. However, the reason I mentioned 7 to you is because it's still supported, won't be supported for as long as the others, but for probably for the useful life of that machine they'll continue to support it. And it is the most similar to what you're already used to in Windows Vista. In fact, really, Windows 7 is really what Windows Vista should have been in the first place. And kind of, you could almost see Vista as being like the beta copy of you know, the one they pushed out too early and it wasn't really working very well. Mm. I mean, Vista was horrible, frankly. I mean,
I've never had a problem with it. I've always got on well with it.
You're lucky. I mean, it's really been, you know, the unpopular stepchild of Microsoft tend to sort of go in waves. They produce fantastic operating systems, then a bit of a dud, and then a good one. So you had Windows XP, which was great. Then you had Windows Vista, which was less great. Then you had 7, which was fantastic. And then 8, oh my God. And then 10, it's kind of recovered a bit. So it kind of comes in waves. And they'll continue to do that until people don't worry too much about Windows anymore. So my suggestion to you is probably if you're not interested in buying another machine and you want to
just at the moment.
Get this one. So then it is a question of getting a Windows 7 license. You can download Windows 7 from the Microsoft website or you can get a disk, but you need to have a license key to be able to run it legally. Before you do any of that, this is a bit of a technical process. This idea of upgrading an operating system is something that Brenda requires a bit of thought. First of all, you need to have a complete backup. Two types of backup, really. One of the whole system, so that if it all went pear-shaped, you could just reinstate it from the backup and it would be as it was before, operating system, applications and data. Then separately, you should do a backup of the data only. But that supposes that you have the ability to reinstall all the apps. So what you would do is you would do a migration to Windows 7. That could be done as an update, but probably a brand new installation. Then one by one you install the apps and then you reinstate the data. And that's quite a lot of work.
Yeah.
And similar though 7 is to Vista, some things may not work quite as well. There may not be, you know, certain things that were working well before may not work. But you can't really realistically carry on running Windows Vista because, as you yourself said, it's not supported by Microsoft.
No.
And what that means is that...
Sorry. As a technophobe, would I be better off getting a man to do this?
Yes.
Or a woman.
The gender doesn't matter. It's just they need to know what they're doing.
It's just the knowledge.
I would look to... I'd look to spend, £50 to £75 on a local trusted expert who will do the backups for you, who will upgrade to Windows 7, who will then reinstate all your apps and data and get it all going again. And that's worth sort of £75 of your money. The alternative would be, you know, to take that money and put it towards a new machine. But even if you had a brand new machine, first of all, it would be running Windows 10, which means that it's much more likely that some of your existing applications won't work. And indeed, you know, your printer could stop working or something like that because
move on.
I can hear the visceral pain when I said that. I'm so sorry.
Life's too short.
So my advice is to go for 7 because it's similar to what you've got. Yeah. It's more likely to be compatible with your existing software and hardware. But yes, I in your position, if you're not confident of knowing what you need to do, then I'd get someone to do it for you.
Right.
Just one thing, and I don't wish to cast aspersions upon anyone, but be present when they're doing the work. Yes.
Okay.
Just because Most people are completely trustworthy, but you're giving them access to your machine. You don't want them. Yes. You don't want them running a spare copy for their own interests.
It's okay. Unless they want to start preaching sermons, there's nothing very interesting on my machine. I don't do things with numbers and figures and things.
Yeah. Have you ever done online shopping or online banking?
I do online shopping, but not banking.
Yeah.
I don't trust it.
But online shopping, if you've ever paid with a credit card and so forth.
Okay,
most people are honest as the day is long, but I just think, and also, you know what, if you sit and watch what he or she is doing, you'll actually learn something about the process as well.
I do know somebody who could do that, who's used by several friends of mine.
Good.
So that's not beyond the bounds of possibility.
Okay.
I have another couple of things I've had time to mention.
Yeah, go ahead, Brenda, go ahead.
Okay, I also have a laptop, which probably is running Vista or something similar.
Mm-hmm.
So that would probably need dealing with the same.
Yeah.
And then if the person who came to deal with the office machine could do that, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also they would might be able to get me online from the laptop, I assume, because I can't get online from it.
Yeah, no, again, and it's probably more cost-effective to deal with both of those at once for two reasons. One, less travel to and from, you know, your home. Right. But also, when one is chugging away doing something, then that engineer can be working on the other machine. So there's a lot of waiting around because, he or she will do the updates and then the updates will take time and then there'll be more updates and then you'll restart the machine. And it's like television. There's a lot of waiting around. And so
work on one while and then work on the other while the other
exactly
doing it.
One final thought, Brenda. Obviously these machines are of a certain age because they're running Windows Vista. One really good way of giving a machine a good midlife kick or late middle age kick in the sense of your computers is to replace the physically rotating hard disk drive where all your operating system programs and data are stored. Replace that moving parts drive with a solid state drive, which does the same thing but has no moving parts and is much quicker, particularly for the laptop, but for anything. And the reason I mention it in this context is there's a real benefit in doing it like this. It is this: your engineer can take out the old drive and treat that as one of the backups. Yes.
Okay.
So that if the installation were to go badly wrong, then you could pop out the new drive, pop in the old drive, and it is your old machine again. It's like having a sort of
brain.
Yeah, it's a brain transplant. And
I could do one of those as well.
Well, not so much for you, Brenda, but the benefits.
I don't know.
The benefits of a solid state drive are speed, noise, heat, power consumption, right? So, and this is particularly important on the laptop because, first of all, you get the speed increase, but both desktop and laptop benefit from that. Then you get the fact that because there's no moving parts, it draws less power, so the battery life on the laptop is increased. The fact that it's using less power means that it's generating less heat, which in of itself is good, but that also means it's quieter because the fans are having to kick in far less often to keep the unit cool.
Yeah.
And finally, because it's a laptop and therefore more likely to be dropped or otherwise impacted, it's more likely to survive a drop because it doesn't have these sort of slightly delicate platters of information on the disks. It only has memory. So
lovely.
I think if you're only going to do one of them, consider upgrading to an SSD as part of this process.
Yeah.
One question, Fevzi. Are we recommending something here that's quite laborious in terms of time and also in terms of cost? Isn't it simpler just to go out and buy a new computer for say £300 or £400?
It is certainly simpler, and you will get a more modern, faster computer. The difficulty is, even with a brand new computer, Brenda would still be faced with installing all her old apps and reinstating her data, and then hoping that all the software that she's running now will continue to work, and it's less likely to work. So I've sort of taken in giving that advice, I've tried to take a pragmatic view and say, you know what, that machine will probably continue to run Windows 7 for another, two or three years quite happily, particularly with an SSD popped in there. SSDs are not as expensive as they used to be, and the boost it will give in performance will be huge.
Okay.
So I think for those reasons, yes, I wouldn't be throwing lots and lots of money at it, but a sort of 256 gigabyte SSD is good. And you know, you don't get that size of SSD in a budget laptop, so you'd start, you know, you would be spending upwards of £400 for that anyway. I took a view. The thing is, if you go for the new machine, you're still going to have to do a lot of work to bring you back to a working system.
What do you think you'll do, Brendan? Do you think you'll go for Febsy's repair job, or do you think you'll go out and buy a new computer?
I'm buying a new house at the moment, so right. I'm going to go for the advice I've been given.
Brilliant.
Because if it gives me another 2 or 3 years, I'll then have a little more money in my pocket and can then, in the new house, in the new area, hopefully find another person who can deal with it and can help me to buy a new one.
Absolutely.
I don't even buy them on my own because I know nothing about it.
I see.
I have friends who come with me that do know things.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I don't get rooked. I've got a third one. Have a time, or is that greedy?
Very quickly. Very quickly.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mobile. I have a cheapo smartphone thing, which I argue with, but the screen has started to dim when it's, and not just when it's due to go to sleep. Does that mean it's on its last legs?
Screen is dimming. When is it dimming? Is it dim at all times?
When I'm using it, when I'm downloading or opening emails, it'll start to dim, and it doesn't go off like it does when it's going to sleep, but the screen is dimming.
Right. Okay. So if we're not talking, I mean, it's a bit hard to visualise, but if it's not the energy saving feature where before the screen goes off, it sort of dims the backlight to save energy. So you see that. If it's not that, then it's likely to be the screen itself. And you said it was a cheap phone, so it's not going to be worth paying an engineer to diagnose it and then, if necessary. I think for that I would buy a new one. What type of phone is it? Is it a smartphone or is it what they call a feature phone, i.e. a non-smartphone?
I've no idea. It's a smartphone, I'm presuming, because I can go online on it and I can do get emails and send emails. Right.
And it's got a larger screen, like a 4-inch screen or bigger, something like that.
Yeah, whatever size it is. I don't know. It's in the hand at the moment.
What make is the phone?
It's a Kazam. Obscure.
Yeah, that is obscure. I would say, you know, there are some very decent Android smartphones. So Android being the operating system, they come in different brands.
Yes, I understand that.
So there are some very decent ones for, you know, very little money these days, and that's something that doesn't exist. We were talking about the pros and cons of Apple and Android-based systems. There are no really cheap iPhones, I think, you know, you're talking of sort of 300 and something plus,
up to 100,000.
So, but for say, even £75 to £100, you can get a very serviceable Android based smartphone. So if you're interested in having the smartphone capability and the internet access and so forth, make sure it supports 4G. Preferably get one that's unlocked. That's to say, will work on any UK network, or indeed a non-UK network. Enjoy it, but don't spend. If you're not sort of into your phones, I wouldn't be spending a fortune.
I don't want to get locked into something where I've got to upgrade for a new model every year and this sort of stuff. I'm a buy a cheapy one lady and use it.
Yeah, I think as long as it runs a reasonably recent version of the Android operating system, as long as the screen, I mean, one of the areas that they tend to sort of penny pinch is on the quality of the screen. So try and see in a shop the quality of the screen before you buy it, or buy it online in such a way as you can return it within, say, 2 weeks or so for a full refund. So if you buy online, pick one with a good policy. And the other thing I'd say to you is, I mean, have you already got a contract, or are you on pay as you go?
I have mine through Tesco's, and I have a Rocket Pack.
Right.
So
okay. So Tesco Mobile. Yeah. So the best way to buy a phone in most cases, if you can afford to do so, is to buy the phone outright, so it's yours, rather than get it on a 12, 18 or 24 month contract, and then have a sort of a SIM only deal of some description. Yeah. Gives you a lot more flexibility. It's a lot simpler, and you're not faced with, you know, complicated contracts as well, which are, you know, which are the devil itself. That would be my advice.
Thank you, Brenda.
You've done well. I hope some of it's
You have done well, Brenda.
Three bites of one cherry. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you very much for your call. We're taking all your tech phone-in questions and answers between now and 3:30 with Fevzy. Excuse me, Fevzy, I've just been eating a chocolate brownie, and that's probably why I feel sound a little bit more bunged up than normal. But
And you didn't share?
No, I didn't, unfortunately. I'll have to send a few over to you.
I've got a high-speed link.
By Skype. Well, it won't be long off, will it? Do you ever reckon you'll be able to 3D print a chocolate brownie?
We'll soon have matter transporters, don't you worry about that. I'll be able to reach out and grab your chocolate brownie myself. By the way, I was in the break. I thought I'll have a little listen to this BBC Radio Guernsey on an Amazon Echo unit.
Yeah.
And I realise it's us.
Of course it is, yes, because we welcome all local radio listeners at the top of the programme, and which is when you get the wonderful Rod Sharp going, "Hello, local radio listeners," whenever he's on. I can't do it in that voice too often because I'll get booted off. But yes, all the local radio stations from 1 till, well, certainly 1 a.m. till 5, take us. And so you're very, very welcome, radio listeners, to us here tonight. And you're hearing Fevzy and you're hearing me, Richard Foster, until 5. We're talking all things tech on 08085 909 693 for your calls. I'd like to hear a few more calls, you know, give us a call and we can have a good chat to you. You can text us on 85058. You can email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. Now, there's a bit of a story to this one, Fevzy. It's a good story as well. John from Darvel in Scotland has texted us on 85058. He is talking about an Apple iPad. He says he visited his brother-in-law, and his brother-in-law had been given an iPad by his daughter, who lives in London. Mm-hmm. He has no landline, no knowledge of the internet. He and John, who sent the original message, opened the iPad, although he says his experience is with Windows and Android. He said he was surprised that the iPad was functioning with the internet. There's an icon on there called Messages, as anyone with an iPad would know. Mm-hmm. And he looked to see if his daughter had contacted him. And actually, all they got was a link to a porn site. The question is, how can they clear messages from the iPad? Not emails, messages. He says, sorry for all the detail, but as old folks, it was quite concerning, as I had heard Apple did not get infections. Regards from John in Darvel in Scotland. Yeah. What would your advice be?
Okay, so John, first of all, iPads can be infected. It's more unusual because Apple pre-vet apps before they go into the App Store. But that said, there is a certain amount of malware on the Apple App Store, arguably significantly less than on the Android Google Play Store. But it can be the case. What you're seeing there may be evidence of an infection, but it may not be. Sometimes websites themselves can be hijacked, for example, and give rise to things being displayed on your screen that's surprising. Apple stuff generally does offer a safer experience, but nothing is foolproof. In terms of the messages, I mean, it is possible to go into the settings and for that particular app, go via settings, which is an icon on the home page, navigate to the app and clear down all the data associated with that app. And by the way, it can be a good thing to do that, even if this isn't the problem you have, because iMessages tend to stay around on the machine indefinitely, and therefore tend to take more and more space up. And one of the best ways of actually recovering a lot of space on an Apple device, be it an iPad or an iPhone, is to delete all the iMessages within it, and particularly if there's a lot of picture messages and so forth. So you go via settings, go to the app, and then delete the associated data. But bear in mind, you can't, unless you're going to delete messages manually, you can't pick and choose messages from a particular person. If you go down that route, you'll delete everything. Mm-hmm. So just be aware and, you know, make sure there's nothing on there that you need to keep. If there is, you can send it to another, you know, to another machine and then delete it all. But just be aware of that. I was also interested to hear, because I think you said in that preamble that John doesn't have an internet connection, so I'm assuming that this is an iPad with a SIM card in it, because you get Wi-Fi only or Wi-Fi plus cellular versions of each iPad.
Yes, yeah. He said he has no landline and no knowledge of the internet. He said he was surprised it was working. given the fact that I was surprised the iPad was functioning with the internet, he says. So John's brother-in-law doesn't have an internet connection, but it was connected to one outside. Maybe he lives next door to a shop or something like that.
Yeah, or possibly what you believe is an internet connection may just be what's known as cached copies of websites and data. So a machine that's previously been on the internet, when you open up the browser, will show you that, you know, many tabs with websites on them, but they're just not going to update. I mean, that's one possibility that really it hasn't connected. Another possibility, as I say, is that it's got a SIM card in it, so it's Wi-Fi plus cellular model. And the thing to be aware of there is, you know, if that is the case, you know, who's paying for that and on what basis are you paying? If it happens to have latched onto Wi-Fi elsewhere, that's not so likely. But if that has happened, be aware that public Wi-Fi, that particularly those that aren't protected by passwords, but any public Wi-Fi is not greatly secure. That was before we heard about this crack vulnerability in the standard WPA2. So WPA2 is the way that we have been told is a safe way to encrypt the flow of data between our device and our router. And we found out that there's a weakness in WPA2, but notwithstanding that, if you go to a public Wi-Fi in a library or a coffee shop or whatever, it's not secure. It's very easy for someone sitting in that area to just look at all the data flowing to and from your device.
Mm-hmm.
So you really, the way to get around that to a great extent is either not to use public Wi-Fi and use the data from your SIM card, or to use what's called a VPN, a virtual private network, which is a program that effectively sets up a tunnel. Imagine a sort of a tube, and your data to you and from you flows down that tunnel so that others on that Wi-Fi network cannot see in. They can see that data is flowing, but they can't see what's the content of that data. Otherwise, you know, your online banking, your private messages, everything is an open book. I won't go into too much detail about how that's done, but I can tell you it's very simple, doesn't require a lot of know-how. And therefore, people really need to think twice about using public Wi-Fi. It should be used as a last resort, in my view.
Yeah. And in terms of just manually deleting messages, it's just on my iPad, there's an edit button, I think, at the top. You press that and then you can go down and select the ones you want to delete and then just press delete. It's quite a simple process.
Yeah, so if there's one or two messages on there that are offensive or inappropriate, then you can delete those. If, however, the device has come to you from somewhere else, then, you know, it would be a courtesy to ask, point out to the original owner, you know, that these messages are on there, and if they don't want them, wipe the whole lot down. And doing that, you know, using edit is a slow process. But yes, you can certainly do it that way as well.
Yeah, absolutely. 0808 590 9693 for your calls. Ross in Edinburgh. Hello there, Ross.
Oh, hello. Hi. It's nice to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Not at all. Thanks.
I'm new to computers, really, so I'm a novice, and please bear with me. I have a laptop, and I subscribe to Norton Security to protect my system. Now, I check on Norton every day to give me an update on, you know, anything that may have been happening within the past 24 hours. And every day, Norton tells me I'm, and I quote, fully protected.
Mm-hmm.
But they also refer to tracking cookies.
Yes.
And they invariably tell me, Norton, they tell me that Norton has fully resolved a gamut of tracking cookies, which can range from 2 or 3 to 18 or 22.
Yes.
Now, I cannot quite understand what this means. Am I watching, or have I been watching something which can be targeted with some sort of potentially disabling threat?
No, not in the main, Ross. Tracking cookies are a concern for reasons of privacy rather than security in the main. So when you visit a website using your browser, that website will typically place a small file on your computer, sometimes just a few bytes big, very small file, which is known as a cookie. And that cookie can be used by the website for various things. If, for example, the legitimate use of a cookie, in my view, is when you go to a website and you interact with that website and it understands, for example, if it's a news website that you're interested in, I don't know, Middle Eastern news, it could take you straight to there. Or, you know, it basically allows the website to function in line with your preferences and common usage. So it sort of adapts itself to you, and it recognizes when you go back to that website that you've been there before, and this is you, and this is how you like to use it. So that's a basic cookie, and that's a legitimate cookie. A tracking cookie is a cookie that stores information about what you did on that website. So let's say you went to Amazon and you looked up a particular product on Amazon. That would be stored. And you may have noticed that if you go, for example, I won't single out Amazon, but if you went to an online store and on the internet and then you went to another website, you might find an advert for the product you just viewed on the first website on the second website. And you think, well, how did that happen? The idea is the second website is reading the cookies laid down by the first and previous websites. So the reason why this is privacy is because it means that the people who are running subsequent websites that you visit understand what you've been looking at before. That's your privacy, and that's why it's called tracking cookies, because the cookies are used to track your behavior online, your preferences, your choices of website, and obviously there can be security implications, privacy implications for that as well. So when Norton, by the way, it's a good piece of software that you have. When it says it's identified these cookies and resolved it, it means it's deleted them. And the reason why they keep coming back is because as you surf, they get reintroduced. Now, browsers have most of them now have what's called a no-track option, where there's a setting where your browser says, okay, we've come to your website, you know, Mr. Amazon or whatever it is, but we don't want to be tracked. Most websites ignore it because it's not in their interest to heed it. So they ignore it. And actually, Apple's Safari browser, for example, now has no track set by default. I think others are following suit as well. So it's a privacy thing. It's good that you're running that. The thing is, you don't want to block all cookies by default, because some cookies are useful and even necessary. Some websites won't even work without if you don't allow cookies to be placed. Just by dint of the way that they function, they won't some of them won't function properly. They'll start behaving erratically if there are no cookies allowed. But what you can do with Norton, and in fact what you can do, are you a Windows user, did you say? So there's a program, there's a free program, or there's a free version of a program called C Cleaner, so the letter C followed by the word cleaner. And that has a nice feature on it whereby it will deal with cookies for you, whereby it will allow certain cookies that you say are okay, but block other cookies from even being stored on the system if they're not on the on what's called a white list, or approved list of cookies. So, for example, your banking website might legitimately need to put cookies on your system and may behave strangely without it, but the football website or whatever that may not need to do that. And you can also experiment with that, because you can block cookies from that website, and then if the site behaves erratically, then you can unblock them for that site. And that's quite a good way to go. So C Cleaner is quite nice also in terms of doing a bit of spring cleaning on your system. Every time you start it up, it will just delete off a lot of the things that have sort of accumulated since the last time you restarted the computer. It's quite a gentle piece of software. It doesn't tend to
Thank you so much. That's such a revelation. You're absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
It's quite a relief, actually. Thank you.
No, it's nothing to worry about. Just your privacy, really.
Okay.
You know, but not security. Don't worry about that.
Thank you so much. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Ross, thanks very much. Ross in Edinburgh, who called us on 0808 5909 693 on the tech phone in here on Up All Night, answering all of your tech problems with Fevzi Turkup from gadgetdetective.com. You can text us on 85058. We've got a really good question here, Fevzi, from Sue, who says she has a very old Dell laptop. And she has a lot of Word documents still on floppy disks.
Yeah.
She says, if she buys a new desktop machine, could she get one that can accommodate her floppy disks? Can you still effectively get floppy disk drives?
Oh, yeah, you can still buy floppy disk drives, external drive that connects via a USB connector. So, it, you know, it should be possible. One of the problems... So there's two issues. One is, you know, to make sure that the drive is physically compatible with the operating system that you're running. But the other problem is that if obviously the data on there is old and it will be have been created by older versions of particular programs. Now, yeah. Word is generally pretty good because when you open old versions of Word documents in a new version of Word, it will normally recognize that, you know, that they're still versions. And then when you come to resave it, which you should do, it will then give you the option of saving it as an old version again, or save it as a current version or a subsequent version of Word. And then that allows you to do much more with those documents. So, but other programs aren't so generous. And so if you had things that aren't Word files, but are, you know, created by an old version of a program, that program may not even exist anymore, or if it does exist, it may no longer support very old, and obviously we're talking very old files here. So you might find that even though you've got physical compatibility of the drive into the new the floppy drive into the new computer, you may still have issues relating to being able to open and read those files. That's essentially it. But the short answer is yes, you can buy USB floppy drives, and connect them via USB to a modern computer. And obviously, it's going to be slow. But the thing to do is get them transferred off there onto a thumb drive or something like that. So a single thumb drive would just. It's amazing how it goes because I was looking, for example, at. The update for iOS on an iPhone or an iPad, and it was installed without my wishing it, by the way, but the download, and I noticed it was 1.44 gigabytes, and that's the equivalent of 1,000 floppy disks.
Yes.
The old high density floppy disks were 1.44 megabytes, and it's amazing that now, you know, the data that would have taken up quite literally a room full of floppy disk drives can now be held on a single thumb drive.
Yeah, it's quite something, isn't it? We forget how the data we use every day has just mushroomed enormously over, say, the last, even 10 years.
Yeah. And it's quite, if you ever got the time to go into sort of a computer museum or something and just look at the old, you know, before the 3.5-inch, there were 5.25-inch floppy drives, and they were physically floppy. They had cardboards around. And before that, 8-inch floppy drives, and before that, punch, paper, tape, and card. It's quite amazing how things have moved on. And, you know, used to get hard drives on computers which cost a fortune, and they were like a couple of megabytes of storage on this humongous hard drive.
And took up a room, I'd imagine.
Yeah. I mean, computers used to be the head of IBM once said, I might be misquoting slightly, but essentially he said that he believed the world market for computers was about 5.
Yes.
That's a 5, because it was a thing that governments would buy, and only the larger governments, and they were the size of football pitches.
Absolutely.
Things have changed somewhat.
And of course, NASA put someone on the moon, I think, with the kind of computing power that you'd find in a mobile phone from about 10 years ago.
Or actually, what's on? Yeah. Well, the answer to that is, of course. Or did they? But,
yes, they
how
did.
How is that possible with the computing power of a pocket watch? They did. It's quite amazing. Well, because that was basic physics, essentially. The formula had to be programmed in. You don't need a lot of computer power for that.
Fair enough. And
in a way, less to go wrong, actually.
The successful novelist. A body at the bottom of the staircase.
Beyond reasonable doubt.
The new podcast phenomenon from BBC Five Live.
Download and subscribe now.
Now, George is in Exeter. Hello there, George.
Good morning. Good morning to you. I've got a bit of a problem because I've got 35 LPs, but they're all in quadraphonic. I've got a Torrens, I think it's a Torrens turntable.
Well, yeah, okay.
And my son said, you've got to get a new pickup.
Stylus.
Because I'm looking for a stylus for a quadraphonic LP.
Yeah, okay.
Have you heard of these before?
Yeah, no, I have. So just for those that don't know, quadraphonics is the idea that instead of stereo, where you have two channels of independent sound, i.e. can be different sounds on left and right channels, you get four channels of sound at a time. So in a room, it would typically be front left, front right, back left, back
That's
right.
That's right, I've got four speakers, but I can only get stereo out of it because I've only got a stereo stylus in there.
Yeah, no, so... The answer is, George, is it depends because so quadraphonics was really a bit of an experiment typically back in the 70s. It didn't take off, and when they were experimenting with it, there were different formats, not just the fact that, you know, sometimes it was on tape, sometimes it was on vinyl. I think the BBC even did a broadcast of a Cliff Richard concert in 74 in quadraphonic sound, so, you know.
Well, they're all American LPs, because I've just come back, well, I came back at Christmas from the States after being out there for several years.
Yes.
And that's when I bought the LPs, but of course, sure. I come back to England, and I went to the music shop, a reputable one, and they don't deal with quadraphonic. Yeah. Nobody's pressing them out, apparently.
No, yeah, no.
They're classics, I've got Swan Lake, I've got Beach Boys, I've got some fantastic LPs.
Right. Okay.
But it's no good be putting them up with a stereo stylus. I won't get the sound. And my son, has, on my behalf, has got in touch through the website. And I've got to get a new, it's a Shure head, apparently, pickup.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to get one which is designed for quadraphonic. And I've got to have the matching stylus because apparently... I'm blind, by the way.
Right.
It's all happened since I've come back from the States.
I understand.
So I've got the music now, but I can't see the... I couldn't see the stylus.
No.
My son would have to put it in. But the thing is, it's got a different configuration on the stylus. It's a twin head thing, apparently, yeah. Which picks up four channels.
So there were... George, there were at least three different formats of quadraphonic vinyl. Okay, and they work in a different way. At least one of those formats was able to provide some form of quadraphonic sound with a normal stereo stylus. But the problem with that is it wasn't truly quadraphonic in that the four channels weren't completely independent of each other.
No, that's why I'm going to get a new pickup, apparently.
But it depends on the vinyl, because if you've got one of the ones that was designed to work with a stereo cartridge, then that's what you use it with. True quadraphonics used not only specialist cartridges, but they also had a unit involved called a demodulator, which would help pull that four tracks of data out of the vinyl groove. So it really depends on how those particular vinyl discs were encoded as to what you need. Some information, you know, as to what standard it is. There was something called UD4, UMX, BMX. It sounds like bicycles, but trust me, it was different. They work differently and require different setups. It's a bit like, you know, VHS and Betamax or something like that. You know, they do the same thing in essence, but they are incompatible standards. And there was
all the records are CBS. They're all printed on a CBS label.
Right.
And so my son could on the web check to see what format's required for that stylus.
Yeah, okay.
Or for the pickup. It's a Shure pickup, apparently. That's in there, but it's a stereo one.
Mm.
But I've been told that would have to be changed. And it's possible that another pair of wires might have to be ran from the head...
Mm.
To the back of the unit.
Sounds like a lot of expenditure for 35 records. I mean, if you're up for it, it's a good experiment to do. But, you know, it's going to be hard to buy many more of these discs. Also, have you considered, is your amplifier able to handle four channels of sound?
Because yes, it would be, yes, it would handle four channels quite easily. But the thing is, it's it's only a pair of wires at the moment for a stereo. So to get it working properly, there's enough jacks in the back, apparently. The guy who's got the music shop came to look. He's pretty clued up, but he's never dealt with it before. But he said that your head on your, I think it's a Torrance, is it? Torrance turntable?
Yeah.
It would need a new pickup with double the wires. He could put that in because obviously if the needle's, even if it's a four-track record with a stylus in there, it's only picking up two channels anyway. With the pickup that's in there at the moment on the arm.
At best.
As you say, it's an awful lot of trouble for 35 records. But I did hear the demo in the shop when I was in the States. It was phenomenal.
I mean, I would caution a little caution, actually, because, you know, you're talking about a good amount of expenditure. You'll end up with a turntable that's set up for quadraphonics, but not for stereo. And you've got the cost of four speakers, the amplifier that has to be able to handle four, because most hi-fi amplifiers are stereo amplifiers, you know, so you could connect up two stereo amplifiers, I guess, and drive four speakers that way. But most amps don't handle quadraphonics in the true sense. They have several inputs, but they will only amplify two tracks at a time. So, you know, you have to think, I think, George, about whether, you know, that's a good use of your funds. If you're an enthusiast, or if you just really, you know, want to hear what's on there and make it come to life, I think that's a great experiment. But bear in mind, you'd have spent a lot of money on what's in essence a dead format, and then you'll have to try and seek out further records via, you know, well-known auction websites and so forth.
George in Exeter, thanks very much indeed for your call. Quadraphonic LPs, quite a niche product, I think. I mean, I was quite. We get so many calls about computers and things, Fevzy. I mean, your breadth of knowledge is always very impressive, but on that one, it was particularly impressive.
Well, there's a benefit in being old. ask me about wax cylinders; I'll tell you about those as well.
Let's go back to smartphones with Kerry in Oxford. Hi there, Kerry.
Hello there. Good morning.
Hi,
morning, Kerry.
Hello there. It's I've recently bought and set up a Samsung S8 phone a few months ago, and before that I had to change my email account because it was closing. It was an old Orange account. And I set up a Google email account just for ease at this point in time. It may change, but that's what I've got at the moment. And I was in the process of adding my Google account to my Samsung S8 so that I could access my email on my smartphone. And the process went fine. And at the end, the process told me about Google services that I could turn off or on at any time for that email account, and it started to list them. The first one said it was automatically backup device data, such as Wi-Fi passwords and call history, but it then timed out and I didn't get to read the rest of the services. And I just wondered what services should I generally be wary of or have on or off for Google services for my email account, and whether there were any obvious ones to look out for or to set up. I feel like the setup wasn't properly finished, in the sense that I didn't get to read these services that I could turn off and or on. So they were just left as they were, that they had them as. Is that something that you can relate to?
Sure. No, absolutely. So probably just a few sort of more general comments. So Google Gmail is an excellent free email account in terms of the functionality it gives you, in terms of the space that it gives you to store your own emails. And the spam filter is, in my view, second to none. It's excellent. That's the plus side. The bad side is it's a free email account because you are the product. Google make their money out of targeting advertising, and the way that they do that is to find out as much about you as they can. And part of that is that they have machines, not humans, but machines that scan the contents of your emails in order to target advertising to you. And you may notice that if you email a friend saying you're going on a trip to Spain, that you might suddenly get adverts for flights to Spain. So there are privacy concerns with that as well. In terms of the settings, you can always go back in and change those settings at any time. They're not settings for the life of the email account. And you can go into settings and look at what they are and make a decision. My general guidance for you would be to allow them to collect as little information about you as possible, to not allow them to do backups and so forth. Look, there's always this balance between convenience and security. So there is a great convenience in allowing them to, make stuff available across different devices, and it all works seamlessly together, and to back it up into the cloud and all the rest of it. The problem with that is first of all, Google gets to know everything. We kind of assume Google knows everything anyway. I mean, the saying goes that, they know that your daughter's pregnant before you do. And I think that's, I would posit that they know who the father is as well. But yes. There we are. But it's not just that they will know, but if you're starting to do things like cloud backups and so forth, and that's just one more place that those emails and so forth will sit. Having said that, of course, emails by their nature are already sitting on servers on the internet. It's just that, it's a bit like King Canute trying to hold back the tide. But there are settings that you should look at in terms of trying to maintain your privacy, both from Google and from other third parties. One other thing that I would mention to you, you said, you've switched to Google for now, but you may change again later, and that you had to discontinue Orange because it became unavailable. Google have not got a very good record at maintaining services either. I'm not suggesting they're going to switch off Gmail anytime soon, but they have switched off a lot of services in the past, and they can do it because, in quotes, it's free. A better way, or one way that you should consider at this point, because every time you change your email address, it can be major ructions, because you have to make sure that those people that you want to know your email address and have copies of it will be updated and so forth. And any accounts that you've set up with an email will have to be gone in and edited at the very least, and sometimes recreated. Another way of dealing with this is to buy a domain name, which will cost you about £10 a year, and then publish an email based on that domain name. So let's say, you got, kerrykerry.com. Yeah, so you could have the email address kerry@kerrykerry.com. I mean, that's a silly example, but you get my point. And then what you can do is give out the Kerry Kerry email address to everyone, and you own that for as long as you maintain that subscription, annual subscription. That name is yours, and you can personalize it and also make it look more professional if you want to use it for business uses. So Gmails don't look professional. I don't know if that matters to you, but it's better to have, if you're a business, it's better to have an email address that's based upon your trading name, not just a generic Gmail account. And then what you can do, you can still use Gmail, but just route it through there. So, for example, any incoming email would come into your Kerry Kerry email, but then just automatically be forwarded to your Gmail inbox. And you still have all the benefits of the Gmail spam filter, but you don't ever publish the Gmail address. And the benefit of that is, let's say at some point you become unhappy with Gmail, or Gmail withdraw their service or start charging a lot of money for it, you could change the Gmail account and not have to change the public email address that you've given to everybody, which is the kerrykerry.com one. So in that way, you've got control over it, in terms of what you're, first of all, your choice of email address, and the fact that it's yours for life as long as you pay this sort of £10 or so a year. And that's a good way, that's a good way to go, because you're not dependent upon any service. Email addresses do change over time. You experienced it. Orange stopped providing it. You had to change your email address. That, especially for business uses, that can be catastrophic. So to have one based on a domain name, so you go to someone like, 123 Reg or GoDaddy, there are many of these registrars, and you have a look at what domain names are possible and is available. So a domain name is something.com or .co.uk, so it could be kerrykerry.com, and then the email address would be, let's say, kerry@kerrykerry.com. That's not a great example, but I'm persisting with it anyway because I've said it now.
It's consistent anyway.
You could do that. So I, you know, and that gives you personalization and a robustness and longevity of the email account. In the long term, it's better. So if you're at the point now where you're moving away from one, but haven't widely disseminated the Gmail account, now would be the time to consider that. Don't have to do it, but you can do it. Oh, there is another benefit as well. It is this. You know, we're told that whenever we register for a service online, we should use a different password on every website.
So, yes.
Yeah. But still, when one of those websites get hacked, as they inevitably will do, they will have your email address, yeah, which means that you start getting spam. Now, just consider this. Because you own, in this case, kerrykerry.com, yeah, let's say you go to Amazon and you're going to register an account. You don't register Kerry at kerrykerry.com. You register, let's say, Amazon at kerrykerry.com or NatWest at kerrykerry.com or Halifax at Kerry, you know, any of those, yeah? So what does that mean? It means that each account is not only set up with a unique password, but is set up with a unique email address. They all feed into your same inbox because you have what's called a catch-all inbox. So anything at kerrykerry.com will still come to you because you own the domain. What's the benefit of this? First of all, when one of those services gets hacked, they not only have a password that hopefully you haven't used anywhere else, but they've got an email address that's useless because it's only used there. Two benefits flow from that, and I'm sorry to take this time, but I think it's worth sharing this. Two benefits flow from that. First of all, you can just delete that email address so that if you start getting spam on that email address, you can just delete it and all your other email addresses will continue to work as normal. But that one you shut down and you can just recreate it. So you could set up Amazon2 at kerrykerry.com, re-register and kill all that spam. Secondly, companies, and I'm not talking about Amazon or any of the ones that I mentioned, are notoriously bad at telling their consumers when they've been hacked. Yeah. But you can use your bespoke email like a canary in a mine, because if you suddenly start getting spam email on that email address that's on one of these websites, you've got a very good indication that that website was hacked, because they're now using that to spam you. And so again, that you may then want to change your password at that point, even before they tell you they've been hacked. Sometimes even before they know they've been hacked, you know they've been hacked, and you can take steps to secure that account.
I see. And just to clarify, how do you direct it through Gmail? What's involved with that? Do you get in touch with Gmail, or is it aesthetic?
It's quite easy to do. So when you buy or rent a domain name, the kerrykerry.com, you get access to a panel of settings. Yeah. So you get a username and password for that domain name, and you can actually go into settings and you can forward, for example, anything in that way, or you can set it up so that you can not only forward, so the incoming work, but the outgoing work, so even though you might be sending via Gmail, you can make it go out through that email account. And it's in terms of use the incoming and outgoing mail service of the email address. So there are basically settings that Gmail will give you or available from Google's website that you use to configure that domain name. That is a little bit technical, but actually the people who sell you the domain name probably can talk you through that, or they will have a guide teaching you how to do that. And once it's done, you don't need to do it again unless you change the underlying email address. It should be there for life.
It's all straightforward. Relatively straightforward, I suppose.
It takes a bit of thought and a bit of investment, but I think part of the fun of it is you can just have a personalised email address as well.
You know. Kerry in Oxford, thank you very much indeed for your time and your call there. John in Salford Keys, I think will be our final call this morning. Hi there, John.
Yeah, just round the corner.
Just round the corner.
Thanks, guys. Yeah,
morning,
really
John.
Enjoyed the phone. Febsey, go on in. It's about connecting a television to a, not a Bluetooth, but a soundbar.
Yeah.
So it has to be done by wire. And I tried to do it the simple way, which was by going from the headphone output on the television into the auxiliary input on the soundbar, which works okay, fine.
The level is too low.
Yes, I've noticed the level's low. What advantages would I get of using an optical audio lead?
Okay, so if the TV has an optical audio output, which many, if not most, do, and if the soundbar has an optical audio input, that is by far the best way to go. Because it's digital, that doesn't make it good in and of itself, but it means that you're not going to, it's not going to be picking up any hum or noise from interference from other signals. It also means that it's in its purest form. It's not losing anything as it goes down that optical cable. The optical cable, by the way, is glass. It's a fiber optic cable. So that's by far the simplest and best way to do it. The levels will be much better, because with the headphone output is a low level. It's not line. Sometimes if you boost a headphone output to its maximum, it can just about pass off as a line level input into the soundbar. Yeah. But it's not ideal, because when you've done that, what you're doing is you're pushing that amplifier inside the telly to its maximum. And any amplifier, that top sort of 10 or 20% of the gain, the volume, if you like, is increasingly noisy, and therefore the quality, in order to achieve the level, you're gonna suffer from more background noise. What they call the signal to noise ratio will be low. So if you've got the option of using optical, it's by far the best way.
Would you recommend that?
I'll need to go and purchase one of those, because normally they don't come with the sound bars. I'll go and get one.
You mean the cable itself, or just
the cable? They're relatively easy to get. Yeah.
Yes, they're easy and they're cheap. Just make sure you get the right length. You don't have to spend a fortune. Don't be spending sort of £40-50 on one. You know, a tenner is fine. And just buy it online, buy it from a retailer with a good returns policy. If you're not happy with it, send it back. But it will save you a lot of trouble, and it will just make things a lot simpler, because if there's ever a problem with the audio, you're almost certain that it's not on that optical link.
And Fevzi, very quickly, you've got about 30 seconds left. You'd recommend that over an HDMI cable, would you?
Yes, I would, for the audio. I mean, HDMI is good because it carries video as well, but I quite like optical audio, you know, to be separate. And bear in mind, you can then use the HDMI connector for something else.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm running out of ports on my telly, which is why I ask. And my HDMI, yeah. I've only got about 3 or 4 HDMI ports, and I think one of them has my soundbar.
You can get HDMI, intelligent HDMI splitters that do that, but it's not ideal. I mean, HDMI is great, but it's limited, so why not use the optical, which is only usable for that and not for anything else anyway?
Absolutely.
It's a nice, neat solution.
Absolutely. Fevzi, thank you very much indeed for your time and your tech responses this evening. Absolutely fantastic to talk to people online. And throughout the evening here on Up All Night.
BBC Five Live.